supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, forsythia, we all know its bright yellow blooms in the spring. In answer to a question about would it make a good hedgerow, we're going to tell you about some of the amazing beneficial insects it also attracts. But mostly we're going to attract lots of your fabulous phone calls today at 1-888-346-9499. Aaron, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Aaron. How are you?
I'm very excited to be here today.
Where is Aaron excited?
Well, my garden is in Blackwood, New Jersey, but I'm actually in my office building in the Curtis Center in Philadelphia today.
The Curtis Center, the original headquarters of the Saturday Evening Post, and still the home of the greatest mural anywhere in the world.
Yes.
Which is a Maxfield Parrish illustration. I believe it's Dawn. In crystal glass by Tiffany, somewhere like in the teens, 20s, and it's a million pieces of glass, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic.
And it takes up the entire wall of one part of the lobby, and if you look at it as you come in the doors, which of course is exactly why it was situated where it is and why it's exactly the height and width it is, it looks like the painting.
It is absolutely stunning.
Oh, if you're a Parrish fan or even a fan of Tiffany, I mean, just those two names together makes you want to see it. All right, well, we got to get back to gardening, Aaron.
Well, I called today because I love your show. You've actually helped me become a less of a brown thumb. I'm the kind of person who can kill cacti by underwatering and weeds by trying to grow them.
Good, good.
But I have a hardy plant that I am afraid to touch because it has become so compacted. I have hostas on my property that have overgrown themselves so much that it's really, there's not much soil left because it's all hosta root.
Right.
I know I need to start digging, but I don't want to lose any of these plants either.
You ain't going to lose nothing, honey. These are the plants from Krypton.
Really?
Oh, yeah, but you ain't going to kill nothing.
Well, you say that, but I already have, so.
You've killed a hosta?
I have killed a hosta. I told you, I am a very brown thumb.
How did you kill a hosta?
I moved it, and it didn't take.
What time of year?
Probably late summer to fall.
Okay, that's not the best time, because as you know, that's when hostas are starting to do their disappearing act.
Okay.
Right now, people like you and I are just beginning to see our hostas again. You know, they're just beginning to show where they're coming up. So my best advice is you give them wait until, first of all, the soil's completely unfrozen. Wait till the soil is a little dry, but dig them up and divide them before they start even getting close to putting out their blooms. Like by the middle of the month or the end of the month of May would seem to be ideal. I have found digging up hostas generally to be a four-man job if you're doing it manually. That's four guys with big pointy shovels, sharp shovels, and they work around the outside of the plant, and they keep trying to push up, push up, push up, and they're going to keep going down further and further until finally they're going to get this giant honking root out of the ground. And when I did this, by the way, no exaggeration, some of these roots were bigger than an elephant's foot.
That's what I've got. So.
And then I started to look at this, and I looked in my gardening books, and it had this picture of someone with two gardening forks just gently pulling the clump apart. And this is when I realized that the person who wrote this book and illustrated it, neither of them had ever seen a hosta in real life before. And that's when I did one of the most manly things I've ever done in gardening. I fired up the chainsaw, and I quartered that sucker. And then I dropped one of them right back into the same hole, filled in around it with lousy clay soil. They don't want good soil. And then I planted the other three quarters somewhere else. They all bloomed that year. If you have a friend who's got a little baby backhoe, that'd get them out of the ground fast. And I swear it's not going to hurt them. So I'm saying get that chainsaw, you know. Cut that.
Well, that's how I'll get the boyfriend involved.
Oh, yeah, sure. Power tools, baby. Now we're gardening.
After I've quartered them up, I need to break up that root any more and spread it out at all, or is it okay in the clump?
By the time I finally got those suckers quartered, I was exhausted and I just dropped them back into the ground.
Okay, fair enough.
This is the opposite of girly gardening. This is not out there with a little paintbrush and a magnifying glass pollinating flowers. This is, I hear the backup sounds of a dump truck when I think about doing this.
Okay.
All right, good luck, Aaron.
Thank you very much.
You take care.
All right, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, hey, Mike McGrath. How are you?
I'm doing good, Tom.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate that.
Where are you, Tom?
I'm in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, sleepy little town called Pipersville.
What can we do for Tom in Pipersville?
I had a friend of mine give me some, I guess what I would call seed garlics last fall to plant. I'm not much of a garlic grower. I've grown similar items, onions, that sort of thing, but never really garlics. Don't know much about them, but I was under the impression that you plant garlics in the fall and they winter over. That's my first question. Does that sound correct?
That it not only sounds correct, it is correct. I always try to start planting my garlic around the time the kids go back to school in the fall and have all my garlic planted before Columbus Day.
Now, that being said, I never got to planting them.
Of course not.
So yeah. I kind of forgot about them. Now they're starting to sprout a little. So my question is, can I still plant them in the spring? Or do I just chop them up, put them in my gravy, and invite you over for a homemade pasta meal?
That's not a bad idea. Now, were you given entire heads or single?
Yes, entire heads.
Okay, so and you never separated the heads out?
Correct.
Okay. Oh, this fall, should your friend decide to throw away more garlic in your direction again, knowing how rudely you treated it the year before, what you do is separate out individual cloves and plant those about 6 inches deep and 6 inches apart in your loosest, richest soil in our area here in the Philadelphia area, ideally in September. So the garlic you've got now is sprouted. The
correct.
Bad news is that the second time around, so to speak, these sprouts will have changed the flavor of your garlic. They will have.
Yeah, I had a feeling, yeah.
They will have made the garlic bitter. Whereby, had you planted the individual cloves in the ground and they had had time to establish roots over the winter, those sprouts coming up out of your garlic would have turned into leaves, would have sent up a central stalk, and then that clove itself would have begun to spread out and form a whole bunch of cloves attached to a head. And as long as those individual cloves aren't sprouting, the flavor is good. Now, do you have any containers? Do you have soil-free mix? Have you ever really grown in containers?
Just my herbs.
I do not advise planting in the spring. But if you go through gardening books, you will often see with garlic can be planted spring or fall. My philosophy has always been it needs the fall and winter to develop a good root system to be able to form big enough heads.
Got it.
But you might be able to get medium-sized heads, but you'd have to act before you could plant outside. Garlic is very winter hardy. How many heads do you have?
Just a couple, three, yeah.
Okay. I would get the biggest container I had, and I would fill it with soil-free mix, a really light mix, not garden soil. And then I would put in as many cloves as I could fit, 6 inches apart and 6 inches down. Don't be afraid to bury those sprouts. They will continue to sprout up above the soil line, and then put it outside where it's going to get a lot of sun. Garlic grows very well in cool weather, and, you know, maybe one bulb broken up in each container. Water it once, but then put it outside right in the sunlight. I'm presuming this is hardneck garlic, you'll know. With any luck, it'll start growing, and if you get really lucky, it'll form a scape in late spring. It'll send up a central stalk, and it'll form a little arrow at the end of that stalk. Cut that little arrow up. Bring that inside and stir that up right away. That's going to be a fabulous light-flavored garlic vegetable dish.
Interesting.
And
yeah.
Then when the bottom third of the leaves are brown on the plants still in the pots, harvest it and see what you get. You're not going to get bulbs as big as you would have gotten them in the spring, but I think you'll be able to turn this inedible garlic into something very tasty, if perhaps a little small.
Wonderful. I'll try that.
All right. Well, call us back. Let us know.
I certainly will. And thanks again, Mike.
Good luck, sir.
See ya.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'm appearing in Maryland this weekend. On Saturday, March 29th, I'll be at the Severna Park Home Show in Severna Park, Maryland. And then on Sunday, March 30th, I'll be at the Harford County Home Show in Bel Air, Maryland. Then it's back to Pennsylvania for an evening presentation on Wednesday, April 9th at the Allentown Public Library. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to install a beautiful hedge of forsythia. I'm beautiful Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, forsythia is a plant that is not just a one-season wonder. Yes, it puts on a beautiful blooming display in the spring, but the plant grows so rapidly and roots so easily, you can turn it into a hedgerow that'll be a great habitat for birds, and perhaps more importantly, for some very important beneficial insects. We'll tell you all about it after lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Julia, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. This is Julia in Oklahoma City, and I have a question about the air problems that come from what's being sprayed on the lawns here.
Okay.
I have four little kids, ages 6, 4, 2, and 5 months, and we spend a lot of time outside. We don't have television. We have a big front yard garden and a playland in the back, And last week, they were outside for a lot of the morning. And then when I went outside, it smelled like the garden aisle of a Home Depot shop.
Uh-oh.
And I was really concerned. And I started looking around. And in less than a mile in my subdivision, there's more than 20 lawns that are sprayed green. In Oklahoma City, this is new to me because we're a military family. I hadn't seen this before, but they spray their lawns and then they want it to look nice and show that they've had it sprayed, so they spray it green.
Now, wait a minute. You're saying they not only sprayed probably a weed and feed at this time of year onto their lawn, but there's a green food coloring in there so the lawn looks greener?
Yes, and it sounds bizarre to me and bizarre to you, but here it's like a well-manicured lawn. I mean, it's like a freshly vacuumed carpet.
And I imagine you have a lot of warm season lawns in Oklahoma City that are brown over the winter, so rather than let them green up naturally, we can force them to green up.
I called the city and asked about it, and they said that they don't have an air quality department, so they sent me over to the state, and the state sent me over to the Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Agriculture told me it's probably, what did they say, a pre-emergent herbicide,
yeah.
And they said it's low toxicity.
Of course, yeah.
In Ohio, where we were before, whenever your lawn was sprayed, you had to have a sign that said, no kids and pets, you know, the little
right.
Specific kid with a line through
mm-hmm.
it. Here, there's nothing.
Good news and bad news, first of all. The good news is that this is changing. For instance, this year, for the first time this year in Maryland and Virginia, there are heavy restrictions on what can be done to lawns and what can be done at this time of year. In some other states, there are restrictions on the kind of poisons that were sprayed on your local lawns. And the pendulum is swinging very strongly in the way of the homeowner, in the home of the intelligent person, the person who's worried about their children. Now, you can certainly look up what the regulations are for lawn care, and they will have regulations. One thing that I can virtually guarantee that should make it almost impossible to spray anything in Oklahoma ever is there are restrictions against spraying when the wind is a certain speed, no matter what. And my memory is the wind in Oklahoma City is that speed all the time. That's the low speed. You know, there's never a calm day. The wind never stops blowing in Oklahoma City. So these people who are applying this, they need to follow the regulations. They're not allowed to spray at certain times of day, and they're not allowed to spray when the wind is over a certain speed. And the only way that comes back at them is if somebody complains. There is a wonderful group that used to have a different name. They're now called Beyond Pesticides. And if you go to their website, that's beyondpesticides.org, they have a map of the United States that when you click on Oklahoma, it'll tell you what the federal laws are, what the state laws are, if any local municipalities have different laws, and they'll also list the people you can complain to and get more information from. The important thing is not to allow the children to play on the lawn or to allow anyone in your home who has walked on these lawns. You're concentrating on inhalation, which is important. But one of the most startling things that we've learned from research is these lawn chemicals persist in carpeting and on shoes. The exposure to children of lawn pesticides is often worse inside a home than it is outside. It's crazy.
You're going to be really surprised to hear that the city has sprayed some parks with this.
Oh, no. Cities and colleges and even botanical gardens are sometimes the worst offenders. And the easiest thing for you to do to protect yourself, because you can't keep kids off lawns, you can't get them to stop walking on the grass or anything like that. But do have a change of shoes ready, or have a no shoes on the carpeting, no shoes in the house rule. Have a mudroom where they take their shoes off, or you can be the mother that gets this ball rolling. I can tell you from experience in Maryland and Virginia, that's how it got started. Was one mom just getting ticked off and starting calling around, and now all of a sudden the Chesapeake Bay is a heck of a lot cleaner and the lawns look better.
Don't underestimate the power of a mom.
Oh, yeah, get out of the way.
I've got it. Thanks, Mike.
All right, good luck.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Marlene, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for making it, Marlene. Where are you?
I'm from State College area. I've called you a couple times before with problems and been very successful. So I have a few more.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how many questions I can ask you, but I have about three. Is that okay?
What are the topics?
Well, the first one is simply fertilizer for three bushes. I want to know if they're acid or alkaline.
And what are the bushes?
And the first one is a euonymus.
Right.
And the second one a viburnum.
Right.
And then a lilac.
All of them, they're relatively neutral. All of them are going to do well with a mulch of compost. But especially the lilac. Lilacs are very disease prone. They're the drama queens of the garden.
Yeah.
So it's very important to keep their base clear of other plants. It's very important not to have any wood mulch near them because wood mulch breeds disease spores. And there is nothing better for the health of a lilac than to spread 2 inches of compost around the base of the plant after all the snow melts and we can get out and play with our plants finally again. And the others, they're not big feeders. They don't need anything special, just a little bit of compost. They tend to grow real well on their own.
Okie doke. And I also heard you should feed a Stanley plum and a Montmorency cherry tree. I should fertilize them now. Is that true?
I've never fertilized my fruit trees.
You don't?
Specifically, no. You tend to get watery, overgrown fruits that don't have a lot of flavor. What I do is I allow my my trees to flower because mostly I've got peaches, and I just think peach flowers are the most beautiful thing on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So I wait until, and that also shows me if there's any dead wood on the tree that really needs to come off. So I prune them when they're in flower, and then, of course, the house is filled with these flowering branches. And then after I'm done pruning, as the baby fruits start forming, yes, I will shovel a couple of inches of compost at the base of each plant, both to provide some gentle nutrition, and again, because peaches especially are very disease-prone. And that layer of compost on the surface of the soil is actually a barrier against disease spores blowing in and inoculating.
Now, I have a third problem. This is a wild one. I've been growing blueberries for 25 years and never had a problem and brag all the time that they are the easiest thing in the garden to raise. Bugs don't attack them. Well, I think I spoke too soon because this year I generally cover them with a row cover when they start to ripen to keep the birds out of them.
Keep the birds off, sure.
Yes, and then I'll lift it and check them. Well, I lifted them this year, and there were clusters of yellow worms about an inch long, just in clusters. And my three smallest berry bushes, they had just stripped all the leaves off. What are they?
My first thought would be they would be some kind of caterpillar pest. So what you would need is the old organic remedy, BT, which is sold as Dipel, Thuricide. You spray BT on any plant, and then any caterpillar that eats the sprayed leaves will curl up and die.
It
generally, when somebody uses the word worm for an above-ground creature, it's a caterpillar pest.
Yeah, it doesn't. Safe? For the berries?
It's the safe for the berries. It's safe for you. Birds can eat the dying caterpillars. Toads can eat the dying caterpillars. It is very specific. It just affects the larval form of butterflies and moths, and only the ones that chew on the sprayed leaves.
Mm-hmm.
You could not be more specific.
Okay.
plants.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like it before. I've had bugs of all kinds, but I've never seen anything like that.
Well, gardening always has something new for us.
Yeah.
All right, Marlene?
Always a fight. Okay, thank you, Mike.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm just doing fine today.
And where is David doing fine?
David is in Burlington, New Jersey, about 20 miles north of Philadelphia.
Oh, okay. Burlington, New Jersey. Sure. Famous location. What can we do for David?
Well, I have a piece of property that I own, and it's very wet and very clay.
Hmm.
I would like to know what kind of shrubs and trees that I could plant here that would do well.
Is it wet without rain? Or
yes. Some parts are wet all the time. Where I'll just say that out front, where there is moss all the time.
Right.
It's not the kind of velvety moss. It's some other kind of moss that grows and is always wet.
Okay, so I'm going to outline two options for you. Yeah, the moss, we talk about moss being a great plant for a damp, shady, acidic soil. But, of course, moss won't grow on standing water. It just wants the soil to be moist.
No, well that is in one part of the yard because it's about almost 2 acres here.
Mm-hmm.
And, like I said, some of it seems to be not so wet, but it's mostly all clay. And if you were to dig a hole, like for a post hole,
right,
you're in a foot and a half, there's water starting to come in.
Ah, that is, you have a high water table. Are you on a well? Do you have, is it your own water?
We don't use our own water anymore.
Okay. But obviously, you might even have something like an underground river running through you.
Hey, I don't know. I guess it could be.
Two choices. One is you can aerate the soil. That would involve punching holes, renting a machine that pulls plugs out of the soil. Now, typically, if you cared about your lawn, you would do this in August. But if you don't care about your lawn and it's as bad as you say, you may want to aerate a couple of different times and then figure out what you're going to do. If you get the soil to the point where it drains well, and core aeration is one of the best ways to do that, then you would only aerate in the fall when a cool season grass would be at its strongest. Aeration alone may not be enough. If you wanted to have a typical suburban landscape, you might have to have drain tiles installed. The best time to do that would be around the end of summer, because then they could, if you do want a regular American lawn, after they put in the drain tiles, if they sowed grass seed in August or September, you'd have a fabulous looking lawn. Clay and a high water table is going to limit your plant choice to like the fingers on one hand.
And what would they be?
The things that, as you notice, the river birch, willows, plants that don't die in wet soil.
Okay.
One way to incorporate those plants and other plants and get a really nice landscape with perhaps less work is what's called a rain garden, R-A-I-N. Now, these are originally designed to help people who have stormwater come onto their property on a regular basis. You know how some houses are situated.
Yeah.
They always get everybody else's runoff. Rain gardens were originally designed as a way to help mediate that, but they can also be a great godsend for a place like yours. So what I want you to do is go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org, and go to where it says at the top of the page, Garden Answers A to Z, and go to R for Rain Garden. And there it will take you through a list of the plants that are used and the different techniques you can use. Typically, what would happen is your front yard or your backyard or both would be regraded. And then maybe a kind of a central pool would be installed somewhere where the water would accumulate during wet times. And in the center of this, you would have plants, including there are even irises, beautiful irises, flowering irises, that need to be submerged almost all the time. And instead of having like a sopping wet grass that's hard to mow and walk on, you'll have one little area that might have a little pond-like effect where you'll get all these birds and butterflies and wildlife and all these beautiful native plants ringing it. And because of the way the ground will now be situated, it will drain the rest of your land, and then you'll still have the lousy clay, but now it won't be the wet clay anymore. All the water will be diverted to this area that's consciously planted to use it.
Okay.
I would bite the bullet and look into at least regrading, maybe installing drain tiles, or I think for just for some reason, the way you're describing it, I think a rain garden would take your problem and turn it into a botanic garden.
Okay.
All right, man?
All right, thank you very much, Mike.
All right, good luck, David.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners with itchy fingers that you should never work in soaking wet soil. Don't do any kind of bed building, tilling, or turning until that dirt is dry. Never cut a wet lawn either. Even the sharpest blades will tear that turf apart, and your big feet will adversely compact the already dense soil down below. And crops like lettuce, spinach, peas, and broccoli will grow just fine in cold weather, but their seeds won't germinate in cold soil. So stick with plants for now. But do stay tuned, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and a dozen great tricks you can play with the spring-blooming shrub known as forsythia. I'm spring-blooming Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, wherein a listener wants to know if forsythia will make a nice hedgerow and how to achieve it. We'll tell him that and more, including how those fabulous plants attract great insects that prey on grubs in your soil. It's a plant that has a lot going for it. We'll tell you all about it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Marion, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, this is Marion in Newcastle, Delaware.
Well, hello, Marion. How are you?
I'm fine. I've been listening. My husband and I are both avid listeners to your program.
Why, thank you.
In any case, while I was listening, I was thinking about Easter is coming, and we are in hope that we are appreciated with either planted hyacinths or tulips or some kind of a beautiful bulb for inside. But then what do we do when we have to take them outside? Here in Delaware, particularly in our section, we have a community park across the way from us. And those pesky furry-tailed rodents keep digging up all the bulbs.
Are you referring to evil squirrels?
Yes, I am. They nest beautifully in the trees right across the street during the winter time. And as I say, they dig up all the bulbs in the neighborhood, it would seem to me.
Yes. No, it's not your imagination. Squirrels dig up bulbs for two reasons. They dig up tulip bulbs and crocus because they're tasty and nutritious, and the squirrels actually eat them. And then they dig up other bulbs like hyacinth and daffodils just because squirrels love to annoy us. And they have a lot of time on their hands. And if it's an especially evil squirrel, they will take our bulbs. They will replant a black walnut down in the hole where the bulb had been. And then I think they set up little roadside stands to sell the bulbs at the end of the season.
Well, at least their bottom line is green.
Oh, yeah.
I have found from an old family relative, she had given me some advice about how to preserve my bulbs. And I've tried to pass it on to many of my friends, and my next-door neighbor is very grateful for it. Carol was about to plant her beautiful irises, and she was going to plant some of her lilies. So I said to her, have you tried using chicken wire? She said, chicken wire? I don't have chickens. I said, no. She said, and the squirrels will jump over it in any case. I said, no. Dig your hole, put your bulb in at the proper depth, cover it just lightly with some composting leaves, and then put down chicken wire. Then you can put a layer of ground cover and then put more compost over it. And she's had them in the ground now for 8 to 10 years. And every year they come up and look more beautiful than ever.
I have used the chicken wire trick in my raised beds for protection against not only evil squirrels, but against cats who come around and want to use my beautiful compost-filled raised beds as their litter boxes.
Yes.
Cats won't do that if they can't scratch up the soil and cover what they've done. And it's exactly the same thing. They dig down in the soil. All of a sudden, they get to this little chain-link fence buried sideways, and they go off to do their evil in somebody else's garden. It is an ancient remedy that is highly effective. It's very cheap. You only do it once, and the chicken wire lasts for years. And as you and I know, once you plant your bulbs or whatever you want to do, you just press that chicken wire down hard into the soil, and it disappears. You don't see chicken wire on top of the soil. And you can do the same thing if they terrorize your raised beds where you're putting in things like tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers. You can actually use the same technique. After you got the bed all filled up, you roll the chicken wire out on top. Then if you got wood frames, it's easy. You just staple the chicken wire to the edges of the frames. And then when you want to put your plants in the ground, just use a pair of tin snips to open up a hole big enough and drop the plant right in. It confounds the heck out of the squirrels. So thank you, Marion. It's been a long time since we talked about the chicken wire trick on the air. And with planting time coming up, you have helped foil a number of squirrels around the country.
Well, goodbye, Skippy. I don't need you here.
All right. I'm seeing a T-shirt with that on it already, Mayor.
All right. Thank you for taking my call today.
Well, thank you for making it. And good luck this season.
Thank you. I'm certain we will have it.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499.
Gunda, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing good, Gunda. How are you?
I'm doing well in eastern North Carolina, Greenville.
Okay, very good. Everybody seems to be doing well down in the Carolinas whenever we talk to them.
Well, this winter, not so. We've been spoiled down here, we Southerners, with good weather most of the time, especially at this time of the year. But our winter has really been harsher than usual.
Well, now you remember what you ran away from, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
What can we do for Gunda in North Carolina?
Well, I have been a member of our community garden, which was started about 3 years ago, and I've really enjoyed being a part of it. Last year, a couple of gardeners were introducing and talking about their wonderful, lush results in the vegetable garden in regards to using cotton gin waste.
Hmm.
And so I thought, I had a source where I could get some for free as much as I wanted to. But then I thought, I remembered too that I had remembered that they use this, what I thought was very toxic defoliant for the leaves before they harvested the cotton. And if that toxic substance was still in the waste product, would that be a good idea to use in a vegetable garden?
Oh, man, you're taking me back, Gunda. This was like the hot button topic back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening in the 1990s, and the state of California and eventually the federal government were getting their organic recommendations together. And there were a couple of substances that had been traditionally used in organic farming and gardening. And this is probably the most controversial one. We called it cotton gin trash.
Yeah.
Because that's what the producers called it. It's what's left over after they get the spinnable cotton, the cotton that can be made into clothing. I guess my bottom line is I wouldn't go near it.
Okay.
Cotton is, at least back then, cotton was the most heavily sprayed crop in America. And one thing that bothered me, because I had come to gardening out of health reporting, was I knew, and you still see this, that some food products still have cottonseed oil
listed
as the, quote, edible oil that they use in like their potato chips or something. And yet, if you read the scientific information on cotton, it's listed very specifically as a non-edible crop, which allows them to spray some of the exceptionally nasty things on it.
That's what I thought.
And I know that outside of the United States, much of the cotton that's grown is also genetically engineered.
Yeah.
And I know that in the United States, virtually all the corn and soybeans are genetically engineered. I'm not sure about the cotton. So in this case, I think your concerns are very valid. The best study ever done on organic farming versus so-called conventional farming, well, I don't think it's very conventional to spray poison on your food before you eat it, didn't please anybody. It was done in the 1990s. And it found out that an organic farm and a so-called conventional farm grow exactly the same amount of food in exactly the same space for exactly the same amount of money. And the difference is that on the chemical farm, a lot of the money goes to agricultural chemicals. And on the organic farm, a lot of the money goes to manual labor.
Okay.
Because there's more physical work involved. And if you think about that, that makes organics doubly better because not only are they not poisoning the planet, they're putting a couple more people to work.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, I appreciate your input.
I appreciate your bringing up a topic I hadn't thought about for ages, and this is one of those thorny issues. It would be great if it was safe to use, but I think you're right. I don't think it is.
But I'm glad this question didn't stump you, Mike.
That's easy. Hey, listen, a broken watch is right twice a day. I get a couple here and there. You know.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Gunda.
All right. Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Grow forsythia for fabulous flowers and unexpectedly beneficial bugs. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, would you read us this week's question, please?
Sure, Mike. Chris in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania writes, I'd love to hear a deep discussion on forsythia, specifically on propagating a forsythia hedgerow from scratch. I would like them as a garden border and bird habitat. Would cuttings be best, or should I purchase plants and bury some of the branches to thicken the stand? In short, what are the best ways to propagate new forsythia? Mike, I know you have some really old forsythia shrubs at your house. Would this plant make a good hedgerow?
Oh, yeah. I spend a lot of time preventing my two old giants from moving towards each other and becoming a hedgerow.
Why don't you let them?
Well, let's see. There's the huge old climbing rose in between them, the magnificent white pine off to one side, the ancient peonies that'll soon pop up out of the ground on the other side, the two peach trees that are planted between them and the house that would like some decent sun and airflow.
And the forsythia are a threat to that?
Ah! Is Godzilla a threat to high tension lines? Left unpruned, those two shrubs would probably be 20 feet high by now. They would get taller, but when they approach that height, the new growth starts to bend over, and every part of the plant that touches the ground tip roots and becomes a new plant. The rest of my landscape would have been swallowed up by this walking invasion long ago if I didn't control their spread every year.
I guess that would be awful.
Well, the sight of that entire area ablaze 20 feet high with a shade of yellow that's unparalleled in the plant world every spring wouldn't be that awful. And it wouldn't be awful for the massive numbers of birds that would happily live in the protection of those giant shrubs. Or for the great diversity of native bees and other pollinators that swarm all over the plants in bloom. Or for the amazing beneficial insect known as the spring Tiptheia wasp.
The what?
The spring Tiptheia wasp. At least I hope that's how you pronounce it. It's a really cool insect. It's a wasp that looks like a winged carpenter ant. It feeds on the extra sugars that forsythia pumps out in the spring, and then it lays its eggs inside developing Japanese beetle grubs in the soil nearby. Then, instead of a rose-chewing beetle, another predatory wasp eventually emerges from the soil. Kind of like the movie Alien, but with a grub as the victim instead of John Hurt.
And these wasps look like flying ants?
Yeah, as we often try and remind our listeners, many insects don't, quote, look like themselves. There's bees that look like flies and wasps that look like dragonflies. The cuckoo wasp is a brighter metallic color than the shiniest new hot rod. There's also a cuckoo bee, but that looks just like a traditional wasp. And there's a very waspy-looking wasp called the five-banded tiphid that looks terrifying but only attacks grubs in the soil, like the spring Tiptheia.
Which looks like a flying ant. Wait a minute. Are beneficial insects this week's question?
No, we're supposed to be making a forsythia hedge here. So, back to the topic. Either buy some new plants or layer new plants from the branches on existing shrubs. Layering is super easy with these plants. Just peg a live branch down onto bare soil, keep the area moist, and then cut that new plant loose when it has its own roots. Then, when you plant the actual hedge, don't crowd these new plants too close together, as the crowns are going to get very large very quickly.
And would you layer or tip root the lower branches between these starter plants to fill things in, as our listener suggests?
At first I thought yes, but then I thought there's a better way. Allow the new plants to grow unmolested completely for a season. Then right after they finish blooming next year, prune back the tops. Those top spikes shoot up really high, and it's always a good idea to keep those bad boys under control. But don't prune the branches coming off the sides. Allow them to grow laterally, and they should naturally join together, just like a series of curtains. That way, you should be able to achieve a pretty solid wall of springtime color within a few years without having the ground so full of roots that the plants can't get any air, water, or nutrients.
Speaking of nutrients, what should you...
Oh, God, no, no, don't feed them. Don't feed them. Unfed forsythia quickly grow into huge plants. If you gave them any additional incentive, they might get up and start walking around like triffids.
Anything else?
Well, the biggest mistake people make with forsythia in general is late pruning. Forsythia sends up tall spikes all spring and summer, and people who cut these shoots back after June often remove what would have been the best flowering parts. You can prune them as much as you want right after the flowers fade in the spring, and you can continue cutting them back for a month or so after that, but then stop. Remember, they're supposed to look a little rangy. That's their habit, so don't try and turn them into boxwoods. Well, that sure was an interesting look at forsythia and its unexpected benefits, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail with links to more information about these amazing beetle grub destroying wasps, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to prune my forsythia in February if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please, please tell us where you live. Please, please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all of your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin, don't call me Merv, Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant is Marissa Nicosia, herself a fine attractor of beneficial insects. I'm always beneficial, Mike McGrath, so I'll go beat up some beetle grubs and then see you again next week. Choosing which live plants to memorialize a loved one is always risky. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to pick the best plant for your place and how to coax along already existing iffy ones, plus your fabulous phone calls.